it's really important to be there. And once you all speak about Tanzania, and then you come in with another group of Christians, and you have nothing but to ask. So I'll try and speak my presentation and think of ways that link the two together. It struck me that this year is the end of the decade. You and your friend, of course, were women and you were you know, they have a year for women and then they decided to take it. Anyway, I was actually involved in the Purple Women Conference. I was working for the UN at the time, writing. I wrote papers on the sex of the party and then the conference. And so I was there on the UN side. There were two conferences going on, one was the official UN conference and the other was the non-governmental organization. And what really struck me came out of both conferences, but quite clearly at the UN, was the kind of rift or divide between third world countries and how they were approaching the conference and the Western countries being very vociferously about refugee association. Which was part of the administration and stillness of the country. And the war in Reagan, of course, the US immigration. And the dividing line was over what one, or what could be regarded as women's issues. And the Western nations came and said, you know, we have this unique opportunity, we have one familiar conference, we want to talk about women's issues, not being defined with those words, I presume, like health and education. But this was not going to be a usual UN political forum. It's going to be third world for them saying that's all very well, but we can't talk about women's emancipation unless we understand poverty, the majority of women in the world living in poverty, and the causes of poverty. And then the other aspect was the third world women saying very emphatically that we can't talk about freedom for women unless we take into account the threats to poverty by women and the threats to occupation and their own personal freedom. That was the thing that really set the rules of the conversation. And both sides were accusing the other, politicizing the conference, my information, by trying to really railroad their view. And in fact, they refused in the end to sign the World Convention. And that had gone in a long day. And that was around the fact that Zionism appeared one country and the World Convention. That's one of the things that went on. So that was, you know, third world women are saying this is an issue that concerns all women, and we've got to look at, from that perspective, immigration and immigration women's issues. It seems that this is going to be played out again in Kenya very, very strongly. And the US apparently has been lobbying like crazy, and spoke to the Hungary, the ambassador to the European The US doesn't use the promise in the American Union. And the number of women here and the same group number of women, very handy. Anyway, so with that, those kind of thoughts, what I think I would do is just look at what the third world position means through looking at South Africa and Mozambique. And taking South Africa, I think it's very clear, I mean, it affects the party of the movement much, much more harshly felt. I mean, it affects the party of the movement by women than men. This is just very simply the fact that apartheid grew out of a need for cheap labor. That, you know, the whole system of apartheid laws could really be traced to the fact that South Africa is a very, very rich country in terms of mineral resources. But that it wouldn't be that rich if it couldn't have access to this incredible resource of cheap labor. And in an effort to maintain this cheap labor, in an effort to make sure that this labor does not make the kind of demands on the quality system that would bring about its end. The resistance with a set of amazing laws. And clearly this is a whole question of racism and racism. But that I think we can't only look at South Africa as a question of racism and racism. So that as long as one is against the labor and is able to provide sell your labor to the white areas, in the white areas. You are permitted as a man in this case, to go from the rural areas to the urban areas, or to the white areas. And the white areas in South Africa are 87% of the country, and they're really attached. It's broken down very, very clearly into what areas are white and what areas are white. Africans have been assigned 30% of the land. I don't know how much people know about South Africa, so I'm a little bit obscure. Of course, the Bantustans, the so-called independent states, have been set up in the 30% of the land, which is very, very impoverished, barren, arid. It's estimated that something like 80% of the people who live in the rural areas in Bantustan live below a poverty level, which means So what happens is that workers who can sell their labor in the urban areas or the white described areas are given permission to travel from the rural areas to the town. They have to carry passes, their permits are very, very restricted, and they're paid extremely low wages. The rationale for that being one of the rationales, but the attempt is to say, well, we don't have to pay after the neighbors all that much, because they have their wives living in the rural areas, and their wives producing their food for the land, and they grow their subsistence crops, etc. So that we don't actually have to give up the very high wages because they don't need them. Women are not seen as units of labor in the same way at all. So that it's very difficult for them to travel from the rural areas to the urban areas to work. They can, and they do, and they certainly do legally on a large scale. But for the majority, it's very, very difficult. And in fact, since 1964, it's been effectively impossible for women to travel from the rural areas to the urban areas. They are not given permission under any circumstances to be able to be free in terms of trying to register legally. So this has meant that women, for the most part, are kept in the rural areas while men are able to go back and forth to migrant endeavors. I can only sort of mention in passing the kind of pilgrimage structure coming up, for instance, in the migrant endeavors I have. The majority of the year, they come back for 2 weeks after they apply. Africans do not have a choice in terms of where they work. They have to, at age 16, get a pass, register to Labor Bureau. And from that point on, they are shunned wherever they move. Employers requisition for labor. They need 100 workers for such and such accounts. The Labor Bureau will then pull a person to work as a account. It's very strict system. Denying Africans any right to receive whatever they choose. There are some conditions by which Africans can live legally in their towns, other than as migrant workers. They have permission to resign. They don't have permission to actually be there permanently, but can resign there. And this is this part of an act of Section 10, Act of War, and to an amendment, of course. It's kind of consolidation. This basically has four categories. One is if somebody has been born in an urban area, has lived there continuously for their whole life, they can qualify to remain here, and then they can seek work by themselves and to go to work. It's very, very difficult to put this category. It's very unusual for a child to, or for an adult to, remain continuously in one urban area. This doesn't mean an urban area doesn't apply to 87% of the land. It applies to one particular district of an urban area. So if you were born in a particular area of Johannesburg and you live there continuously, then you can qualify as a Section A. Section B, somebody who has lived, has worked continuously for the same employer for 10 years, or worked continuously for 15 years. Again, this is something that is very, very difficult to control, both of the employers knew. People get laid off, they would have to find another job instantly in order to qualify. And again, people do qualify, but the numbers are the third category is a wife of one of the first two categories. If she is married to a man who has rights of residence, she can then live with him. However, she she has to have to enter the urban area legally, which again is something difficult to do in some sense, or her own job, and has to ordinarily, as they say, reside with her husband, which means that she has to live in a house with her husband. Now there's an incredible shortage of housing, and it takes like 5 or 6 years for an average family to get a hospitalization. During that time, she was not living with her husband. The hope of getting a house, I mean, something like 160,000 shortage of housing in South Africa, who was living townships surrounding the environment. So it's quite clear that the impact of poverty is very, very harsh. The majority of women live in the rural areas, cry and support their family. Very, very dependent on cash income from husbands or sons or fathers who are working in their family. As I said, the land is very, very impoverished. It means that women cannot control their role as prime producers for the family. They're just unable to do that. This in itself has been a key way in which women have gained a certain amount of status over the years. In the sense that they are providing funding and providing food. Unable to do this, it means that they feel absolutely left and deserted. Their own sense of themselves is very affected by the fact that they watch their children die and they cannot provide food. And there's absolutely no way that they themselves can change that situation. I just wanted to mention one other aspect in terms of its effect on women. This illustrates the hardest for poverty, there's no question of renewables. What happened is when the government's sectioned off the country, there were a number of African communities that were caught within their white areas. Many had lived there for many, many years, generations, centuries in some places. Some had been actually owning land because they had bought land from farmers before 1913. In 1913, the Land Act was passed, which forbade the transference of land from whites to blacks. The blacks could no longer purchase land from them, and that's what was ended. However, that law was not retroactive, so people had actually bought their land before 1913 could remain, and there were large numbers of indigenous people that lived in Israel. So what happened was that these so-called black spots in the war were sort of blue in the face of apartheid in the sense that it wasn't rational. It didn't look right, but so, and it didn't fit into the whole scheme of apartheid. Everything would have to be removed. There were also people that lived on white farms, who lived there for many, many generations. They too lost the right to remain on that land. There were squatter camps in the urban areas, particularly around Cape Town, where people had entered illegally to live in the towns in order to be with their families. There was a need on the part of the government to move these people to the towns. So there was a whole sense that anybody who did not, who could not tell their neighbor, or lived in any of the wider areas, even if on the time of these no longer had these rights. And since the beginning of the 60s, a whole campaign of illegal relocation had been underway, and without exception, it's been pushed into the area because nobody has been willing to leave the areas of Grand Northern and Washington. 3.5 million people have been moved since the early 60s, another 2 million on the threat of removal, and over half of those 2 million are in black spots. And I was in South Africa in June last year, and the footage of the number of removed areas was just extraordinary to see what has been done. In terms of pressure being put on people from a removal area, I visited the leader who started off as a real moderate, who felt the order by the government in 1980 that said it would remove to the people. But now he stands government can't do this. Began to petition the government. It was quite clear, petition after petition, that they were going nowhere and that the government was getting very excited about growing resistance in this community. much more militant in 1983, and over the Easter weekend, which called a meeting together, a community of policemen came onto the territory, said this movement is illegal, they said it's not illegal, 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 the residents found this car, began to get very angry, policemen went to his car, took out a rifle and shot seven people. Interestingly, the person who's now replaced him as leader is his wife, Major Matusa, which is a very unusual role for women in these areas. She's been very, very strong. And even resisting removal. As part of the kind of removal campaign, the government begins to withdraw services from the community, begins to stop allocating old age pensions, stops the bus services, refuses to build roads, takes away medical services, starts transferring teachers that are too active. This is the way that they want to get people to move voluntarily. And what they do very, very noticeably, and this is happens, it's very fixed, is that they, if they cannot find a leader in the community that is willing to pay more with the government, they will then institute their own leader and say, this is the leader of the community, this person is willing to move, the teachers are being bought off, promised houses in or particular land in the areas that they're going to move to. And he will then negotiate with the government and say, well, this can only be to live in because we negotiated with the leader and the leader's willing to move. I think what I'm trying to build up is this picture of South Africans in general, women particularly, suffering horrendously under this. That in fact it was very difficult to imagine in the real sense of how women can liberate the importance of it. So I mean, there really is that myth. And that's, you know, that's something that we have been discussing at Copenhagen. On the Mozambique side, that is, I think, very was very inspiring, let's say. The independence of Mozambique, which is a country that borders on South Africa, and fought over a decades war of liberation against Portuguese colonialism, gained its independence in 1975, which is the beginning of the decade, and was celebrated its 10th anniversary about 3 weeks before the Nairobi conference. It was looked to by many people, feminists, people who are interested in the process of social transformation, revolution, change, as a real example of how Mozambique's involvement is. They certainly have very, very strong ideology in terms of how they want to approach the liberation of women, which is something that was taken into account during the war. Women were really encouraged to participate in the armed struggle, to take on leadership roles, and were heavily mobilized in terms of the activities within the liberation movement at the time and the power in Mozambique. But there was the other facet to this was a clear recognition that the liberation of women was essential to the revolution, and there's a statement by Simone Show, who's the president of Mozambique, and was going to leave the main leader in the war. The liberation of women is a fundamental necessity for our revolution. A guarantee of its continuity and a precondition for it. So it was very clearly stated that we can't in fact even think of a successful revolution, of a successful process of social change, unless we take into account the role of women and we need to change that. And certainly for the first years and continuing, there was a lot of attention given to the role of women and the need to integrate women into the development process and for that development process to reverberate back on women's roles. There wasn't just enough for women to be integrated, but for women to actually play an active role in that process. How one could see this being done, I mean, one area that I looked at in my research on Mozambique over the last few years, was the impact of rural transformation on the rural areas. probably about 90% of most neighbors rural, and about 90% of the rural population that has been added one by one, or at least are producers at this point in time, able to build them. What followed was the institution of a program of socialization of the countryside. The land was nationalized, and three areas were looked at in terms of the socialization: the development of state farms, the development of cooperatives, and the development of the communal villages, which would then deal with prohibition of family production. I'm trying to be short, and I can sort of sum this up, and if there are more questions later, where there's interesting parallels between Tanzania and Zimbabwe. The state farms were, well, in state of policy, in terms of agriculture and development, all of these three aspects of socialization would be given equal weight. And that was stressed again and again, and you read the documents that came out by the congresses or government documents, and this is very, very interesting. When you look at actually what happens, that wasn't the case. The state farms were focused on almost exclusively. A lot of aid came from socialist countries, but there was also aid from the UN and other sources. Developed state farms. Many of the state farms had been Portuguese farms, owned by Portuguese settlers, some by some corporations, but a lot of them were actually farms actually owned by settlers. At independence, 250,000 Portuguese settlers fled the country. This left a lot of land available. The rationale of the view was that these farms have been worked for many years, they've been successful, all we need to do is take over the farms and continue. We will take them at the state farms, we will pay our workers, and we will continue to keep them busy. In fact, there was a lot of problems with this process. For one, the wages were needed to be raised, and so the depression of profits, the depression in terms of any profit making entered quite significantly by the fact that the wages were raised. But there was, from one end of the country, enormous problems, not really aid to the profession. Technology and how that was introduced. It meant that by the end, by 1983, when the fourth party congress was held in April, it was very openly admitted by the new member of the government that the state farm policy was there. And that the goal that the state farms would produce enough food to feed the country as well as be able to export crops such as cotton, that this had been hopelessly overrated. And that's, so the emphasis on state farms is going to be moved away and we really focused on family production and to some extent on private production. And I think it's fair to say that probably there's not one state farm in that generation shown up since they were established. I mean, there are a number of reasons for that. The next area was the cooperatives. This again was stressed very, very strongly. The cooperatives were seen as providing an economic base for communal villages, a way in which people would work together collectively, grow particularly cash crops, but also, to some extent, crops for consumption. These also failed. Not totally, I mean, there are some very impressive crops that are working, and that I think is more to do with the political level of the people that work on them in the cooperatives, and just particular conditions that have existed. Because in fact, the cooperatives have very, very little resources and help from the government. The intention was to get a lot of help. In fact, there was very, very little in terms of availability of both resources and personnel. Mozambique, just to point out, very good here, obviously, middle level leadership and technician, is that Lima inherited Mozambique with a 90% illiteracy rate. The Portuguese had not developed any kind of educational system for the Africans. It's very, very, very important. What they did, which is different from the French version, is they imported nearly all the people that came to run the civil service. So that there was no applicants that were educated to a point where they could actually fill the roles of the civil servant. Very, very minimal. So that when the Portuguese left, they just emptied out the ministries, administration, schools, medical services. And it was very difficult for Mozambique to then replace them. We found situations where Portuguese with a university degree would be replaced by someone with a career. And it wasn't there was a real gap in education. And so this reflected down in terms of state farms as well, but particularly the Christian farming and farmers. The third area was the communal villages. Communal villages, which were seen as the core of rural transformation. The people would be encouraged to live in these villages. People tended to live in scattered households. The feeling was that in communal villages we can provide all the services that are needed, schools, health, etc., by bringing people together. And something like that, about 10% of the rural population are in communal villages. There was a real attempt initially not to force people in communal villages in order to try and make them so attractive that people would normally or go there because they saw the benefits very clearly. In fact, this is, there has been some forced villagization, mostly because in this problem, it's come to number quickly, the whole activities of South African environmentalism. What I'm trying to say is that Mozambique set up a program of socialization of the country, which on paper looked very, very good initially, but which when you look at it 10 years later, it has failed. And which had a tremendous impact on women, given that women were the primary producers in rural areas, that when you're talking about setting up communal villages, it's really the women that would either benefit or not benefit, depending on the success of their village, by being able to be active in the carpenters, by being able to grow their own crops of land that was allocated to them, and then ultimately it was hoped that through the example of the carpenters that family agriculture would become collectivized as well. And this was a very, very long term goal. So on paper it looked very, very positive. What happened in those 10 years was a series of problems. One, of course, the whole question of policy and mistakes that they made, which they acknowledge they're not trying to change. However, the point that they began to try and change them, the economy totally collapsed. This was affected very, very, one of the main effects of this was the fact that South Africa set about the destabilization program in Mozambique. They did not want this country on their borders that was being successful in terms of showing that socialism could work, number one. Number two would then support the African National Congress and its struggle against the apartheid regime. So that South Africa was very threatened by Mozambique. What it did was pump millions of dollars into a movement called the Movement of National Resistance, the NNR. He began a program of trying to destabilize Mozambique and has been very successful, particularly in the last year and a half. Additionally to that has been a series of natural disasters, floods, drought, have been very, very authentic in Mozambique, particularly in the last few years. It's estimated, and I think it's a low estimate, the estimate of 100,000 people have died in flood. So that Mozambique, with their very limited resources, have had to deal with trying to just keep people, they have to deal with trying to put a lot of resources into fighting with the MNR, which led ultimately in March last year to the signing of the accord with South Africa in the hope that South Africa would pull off the preserve a pact that basically, a non-migration pact between two countries, Mozambique wouldn't support the ANC in terms of providing bases, which in fact they never did, but they moved the bases. And South Africa would pull off the MNR, cease to support the MNR. In fact, the MNR has activities have increased since then, fixing that their focus on the cost of the American government at this point. And Mozambique is still in a very, very situation at the moment. So that again, one can just see, in terms of the Third World Women's Leaders Conference, that we can't talk about liberating women until we deal with the question of poverty and the causes of poverty. And I think we must make this very clear, can be clearly shown. However, there's another view of this that is where I would come from, is that I support that view, part of that view, that we can't talk about liberation of women unless we deal with poverty, and we can't talk about liberation of women as the world of women unless we really look at where women are placed. Poverty being a prime example. There is, however, the question of what women's liberation means and beyond that. It would be nice to believe that if we just did away with poverty and just did away with poverty, that in fact we would gain our freedom and space. And that something else needs to be looked at. And I think, again, Mozambique is a good example of that in the sense that they had all the fine words that were needed in terms of liberation of women. They really did put a lot of programs into practice in a way that I've not seen in my limited view of African countries, my experience of other African countries. There were programs that were put into effect. There was a lot of mobilization, political mobilization around the theme that women can do what men can do. And indeed, if I State Farms, there are women traffic drivers, you find women driving trains, you find women bus drivers, you find women mechanics, auto mechanics, in factories and on State Farms. We also have a sense that women can do these jobs and must be encouraged to do these jobs, and it's our responsibility to make sure that women are integrated in these areas of work. What was not stressed with British labor was no, we can't go to possible. Men and showing for example women. And I said, well, what example is that? And they would say, I'm going to teach you to yourself. Work hard. Women have to work hard. You know, they get up an hour early and they go to bed an hour later and they show them that they really can do all these things. And then men will see that they work very hard and will automatically do it. But it's not for women to push for it. And so one can have a vision of women with an incredible capability, and forget the double burden. But they're very, very active in the home, responsible for childcare and all domestic labor. They're responsible for production. They are then responsible as militants to be active in political activities, and maybe a member of the People's Assembly, or a member of the women's organization, or a member of the justice program. And that it was quite evident to me when I was traveling around with the villages for my third visit, that there was a real sense of demobilization in the villages. And my sense was, and in the next sense, that a lot of that was to do with the fact that women just couldn't help. And they had so much to do with people that women didn't have time to go with decisions to do that. And so that until, and this is the base line, that until the question of women's production is really difficult, that any kind of idea that we can liberate women in a fundamental way gets totally stolen. And that Mozambique has not been dealing with that. We've been dealing with lots of political aspects, not going on and saying, what are we going to do in terms of the national question? And if you pose that question and say, well, women are going to deal with that. In fact, women are now in a much, much more difficult situation. The parallel between women in rough areas and what I was describing in the in South Africa, the women are not produced for the family, and the kind of impact that has. That if, you know, any of us not, then maybe it's being idealistic, but that if, in fact, at the beginning, most of you have gone to the women and said, what do you need? What do you need in terms of development? Do you think we should support the state farms? Do you think we should support the project? Women, I think, would have very much have responded by saying, no, you know, what we need is we want to feed our families and we want to help her. And that in fact they have developed the family agriculture to a point that that would become the basis and not have a view that the state farms would be the basis for agriculture.
I just want to ask one question that maybe then will be addressed by the speaker and the mayor. I have very limited experience with Zimbabwe recently. And the problem, and you have mentioned this, you may be cooking organizing something, but one of the big problems there, besides all the problems that we have, is that they have a millennium of private sector which are there, and the government doesn't dare touch, and eventually they'll have to be changed, but until they're changed, it's so depressing.
I think that's a very interesting question, because it's a very big time and most people can kind of push the problem through. And let me just... I think it's an interesting point. Is that Buttonleaf's attitude has been very, very clearly that these customers, any customer who's given to people in any form must be eradicated. And that when we look at women, we talk about women's emancipation, this is a very key question. The war of right price for forced marriage or polygamy, which is another aspect of it. So Mozambique has said basically that our culture has been so denigrated by the Portuguese and our history has been taken away from us that in order to revamp and read with a new sense of ourselves, we need to look at our own culture. But just because a custom is African does not mean that that's good. And they started a very, very strong campaign initially, and which actually still continues against polygamy and against right price. And they saw again the communal religious as being the areas in which these could be built the most effectively. And a lot has gone on, and there have been very, very significant changes. And it's not a question for us that mainly blame in the middle, but that there would be a lot of political education and then particularly in the United. And my sense, and again, I can give a lot of examples, but I don't know in terms of time, but my sense, overall sense, was that in the communal villages and talking to women in the towns, that amongst the younger women there was an absolute clarity that they would not accept their husband's marrying another wife, and that this was their choice, and that they were backed up by the government and they could go ahead with this. Same thing about the war, and I spoke to a lot of women in the villages that refused to have the war exchange, and this created tremendous public violence for the families. But this links directly back to the whole question of production and women's role in production. Because if women are seen as workers, then for a man to have more wives means that he has more workers. Mm-hmm. And the war forms a real economic input into the community. And then to suddenly stop that when a whole family is geared towards the expectation that they have two daughters and one has two, those daughters are going to be married at a certain amount of time to come in. That's kind of capital to that family. You wipe that out, you know, from 1 year to another, and that's so that again we just come back to the same problem, that unless you're going to really change the economic base of the villages and of the villages, that it's all very well to talk about any polygamy, but it's a point at which you can't get into it. You draw a certain point in terms of political education to economic. Zimbabwe has not come to touch it, and they've been very, very good.
Should I go with it and then I'll try to have more questions to be told? In listening to Stephanie, I once again see the parallels to what has happened in the last 20 plus years in Tanzania. I think most people have some sense of the struggle of government in the around 1885, German colonial rule was established. That followed centuries of major changes that were identified in the 16th century, especially slave trade and slavery, especially 19th century settlement of slave plantations and things kind of thing. That's a very important part of understanding these principles for the present. British moved in from the 1920s, independence, 1961, the Usher Declaration, 1967, tremendous economic crisis experienced in the 70s. In 1985, the way in which I look upon things these days is to see a new phase of colonization in Tanzania, but in all of Africa. And therefore, I don't see that complete break between the history of South Africa and the history of Tanzania, although it's obvious that they have very different histories. But some of the same actors, especially on the side of capital in South Africa, are also very present in Tanzania. And increasingly, you'll be seeing certain policies of violence, and going to be followed. So that if there were time, it would be important to really trace movements of capital in Tanzania. In Tanzania, it's not so much mining, it's agribusiness. Both in terms of investment directly in production, in the colonial period, the sensitive plantations were the major source of export earnings of modern state. More than 50% in mining, but also tea was a major sector, and sugarcane began to be important in the team. Coffee was half and half present producers, and then the sector producers, etc. But the other phase of agribusiness, and one that became much more important after independence, are the big transnationals who don't have to move directly into production, but who are the major buyers of produce by peasant producers, who package and transport, who control all these different operations. And especially in the 70s, became important in Tanzania in providing feasibility studies to promote even a crop like having maize, which was supposed to be for local consumption, as well as cotton and other major export crops. They are the ones who provide the inputs like fertilizer and insecticides, and even some of the hybrid seeds. So that agribusiness has been shown in Africa, as in the United States and Europe, to have very complex way of operating, vertically integrating producers who may remain family producers, but increasingly are on top to the banks and to the agribusiness. In the case of Tanzania, not so much directly to the banks for the majority of small producers, but through the Tanzanian state. The Tanzanian state is the one who's directly in debt to the combination of World Bank and the funders and the agribusiness, and then must itself be forced to act upon the producers to come forward with their problems. Certain kinds of crops, the ones that they can sell overseas to get that foreign exchange to repay their debts. So that the integration has this significant aspect of state, not separate, but a part of the operations of capital in this situation, and increasingly being forced to take certain coercive lines of relationship to the producers. Now, in recent history in Tanzania, you could see there was what I would see as a kind of flight of capital out of Tanzania after, not immediately after independence, but because of the strength of the kind of social welfare mode of operation and ideology of the leading party, Tanu, it did begin to really move out in 65-66, probably some form of the capital crisis, as well as other forms of crisis that helps to explain the 67 years of operation. They are coming back. And they're coming back not just in these operations of agribusiness without direct investment, but increasingly now indirect investment. If you're aware of the push of World Bank at USAID, it's a promotion of privatization in agriculture, in the case of Tanzania, as an industry in Tanzania, but elsewhere. A push against state ownership of enterprises, be it state farms, state ranches, as well as state industry. That doesn't mean against state intervention, of course, because when it comes to regulating the labor force, they want the state to be very active. But as far as state ownership, if that blocks the movement of private capital, be it within, but especially from outside, increasingly there's an upfront push against it. And you can see that if you look through the IMF package demands, which have been struggled over for the last 5 or 6 years in Tanzania. It's related to things like doing away with whatever little remains of state control over imports and exports. Now, in terms of understanding the 70s crisis, there are several aspects. We can talk about the food crisis, we can talk about the crisis of backward capital investing, both in agriculture as well as industry and elsewhere, a crisis of incomes and a crisis of unemployment. And these have particularly affected women. First of all studies have shown declining wage incomes for the whole period of 70s up until the present, where they have had to adjust, of course, the absolute wage levels to the standards of women, have found that real wage is declining in all spheres, even including the middle classes, farmers, and wage earners. Also, producer prices have been declining in real terms. The peasant producers at the younger and most productive ages, we could argue, as far as being able to work hard, are up to 66% women. So that when we talk about declining producer incomes, we are talking about women. In other words, agricultural policies have to do with women because they are the ones increasingly dependent upon to produce. And when people talk about a crisis of output, which is the other side of it, for the 70s, they won't say out loud that there is concern about these women. They're not behaving in some respects the way they say, or the way certain credit agencies will help them behave. Now, part of the issue is women have always put, first and foremost, producing food that will keep their families going. Secondly, food is a cash income. I mean, it's a cash crop. It isn't true that food is just for subsistence. Immediate home use food has become increasingly important as a cash crop. And it puts women into a bind because women have also become increasingly important for providing cash needs for their families. They've got to sell some of that food, like maize or corn, in order to get other kinds of food requirements, in order to get kerosene, in order to get salt, to pay for school uniforms for their kids. This is true whether it's a female-head household or a husband and wife kind of situation, and not it's a polygamous. Increasingly, women are forced into finding ways to get cash. And why is part related to the increasing significance of cash for families. Money is needed to buy food for a part of the year for most producers. So that the concept of the subsistence producer really has to be corrected these days. It's only the more sort of middle-level farmers who can make it and even have a surplus, a true surplus, to sell. And then you get into the ranks of more wealthy producers who actually are buying up from their poorer neighbors and are able to sell at the time when there's a scarcity of food and make money on them. But for a very large proportion of producers, it's increasingly difficult to buy. So women will try to find ways to increase the cash they get from that food by brewing beer. So you see a lot of the food stores going to beer production. And this becomes a source of contention, of course, for the government. Because on one hand, it means women have an independent, kind of independent source of income outside of producing an export crop, which is where the government makes money in the world too. It means that they are not necessarily available as cheap labor, bigger agricultural enterprises, because they can make more money producing something like beer and selling it, and perhaps have more freedom of mobility than they would have as a casual laborer. And a casual laborer may mean a very long day's work, but on terms with no worker benefits. Casual labor simply means you are hired for the day, and usually not at the government official wage rate. Now, another aspect of this pauperization, which has been taking place in the countryside in Bethune, is what has been called, in the case of India, finance intensification. That money is needed to buy fertilizer, to buy some of these special seeds, to buy insecticides. And historically, women have been the less, have been least having access to large enough sums of money to invest in agriculture. So they're increasingly not able to keep up with increases their impoverishment. And then you will find women who will talk about going to work as a casual laborer for a larger peasant, perhaps in the same village, in order to get enough money to buy a small package of fertilizer. But she won't be able to buy enough fertilizer to really get economic use out of it. So that it isn't that women are ignorant or backward about the use of modern inputs, they just don't have the means to get enough. So this finance intensification is, of course, not just affecting women, it's affecting the whole countryside. It's related to what could be called polarization. In the countryside, there are some folks who are getting more wealthy and are able to hire in a more sustainable way their poor neighbors. And the finance intensification hooks up immediately to credit agencies and agribusiness, because what people need to buy money, and what people need money for, is to buy an imported commodity produced by a variety of reasons, like fertilizers, etc. Or it may be the case where an agribusiness moves in and says, we'll build a fertilizer plant for you, or we are going to be a part of your, like, recently in the last few years, there's been a cotton promotion scheme where major transnational cyber business has been involved. And then another one has been involved in providing insecticides and fertilizers that are specifically needed for cotton produce. And it will be funded, in this case, by World Bank or by another agency. So you see World Bank's credit programs to Africa profit agribusiness, which provides those commodities, which the government then becomes in debt for as far as procuring, and then tries to force peasants to use. I've been working in one area, Rungwe, where tea was promoted by a World Bank scheme, especially during the 70s, by a smallholder tea project. Rungwe was most successful in protectionizing the quickest adoption of tea as a continental cash crop. Why? It's partly because this was an area that used to be a labor reservoir for Southern Africa. And that's the link partly to the history of Tanzania and Southern Africa. Rungwe, 90% of its men worked south in the 50s, sometime in the liars. At any one moment, up to 50% of the men were born. But in the 50s, it was primarily copper belt for this woman, very Tanzania. But before the 50s, many of the community's men had moved down to Johannesburg, or they were working in Southern Rhodesia in the big farms. And again, relying upon the labor of women back in Rungwe to keep the families going as far as production of food and providing a way to absorb the male labor migrants coming back from their production. Sometimes the women joining the women, especially going to the copper belt, so that the migrant labor history in Tanzania, it does involve women to a larger extent because of different kinds of policies, partly by the companies down in the copper belt that actually began to encourage family movements rather than single back the so-called actual men. But once again, Tanzania depended upon migrant labor, not only as an export to Southern Africa, but to work with sisal plantations. And again, that was primarily male labor moving to sisal plantations, the women remaining behind. And you can look at a colonial policy to keep women in the reservoirs, maybe we should call them reserves, in the countryside and producing. I think we can see a parallel to present policies also to keep women in the countryside, productive in agriculture, and to try to regulate or stop their increasing involvement in other forms of primary commodity production, such as beer brewing, processing, and sales of penny trade of various different kinds, including what has been called the black market, both in towns as well as in the countryside. These activities are being supported. Now, when agribusiness sets up a direct production, a big farm, what's happening, and also smaller commercial farms that may be owned by Tanzanians or they may be owned joint ventures with outside, some of them are still fairly small, as well as what could be called richer peasant operations. The kind of labor relied upon is primarily what is called casual labor, or referred to. And it's usually required on a seasonal basis, not on a long-term basis. So people can't look forward to a firm security of wage employment. It means that depending upon prices of a given crop on the global market or in the local market, depending upon the weather, etc., there may or may not be a demand for labor of a certain scale. And women have been a major pool of casual labor in certain areas such as the tea estates and Southern Ireland. They have been a major pool for agro-processing industry, certain aspects of grading and sorting coffee, for example, for the majority. So that women, what I have been arguing, looking through trends during the 70s and the present move for privatization and large-scale agriculture, is that increasingly women are going to be casualized as large-scale agriculture is promoted in response to demands by the World Bank and the USAID, which in Tanzania has become increasingly important. But that does not necessarily mean that women can look forward to wage employment as we may understand in the context of domestic. It means that women can neither make do as casual laborers, nor can they increasingly make do as peasant producers. They've got to combine all these different sources of income to survive. And this is what seems to be happening in a different pace and scale in different parts of Tanzania. We can't just generalize what's happening in Tanzania. So in studies, it's been possible to show that in some areas, half of the men who we would call peasants are actually categorized as wage-employed people. in certain areas of Tanzania
already.
And a fourth of the women living in subcategories in certain areas. This is according to census data, which will be an underestimate because it doesn't deal with what happens sporadically, where somebody is hired for a couple of days by one person and finds it another month, finds another job, just waiting for somebody to want somebody to work for them. And those will not be captured by any of the official statistics that we have in our command. Now, I just want to close by talking about the impact of the export drive. Tanzania, after independence, in spite of 67, aimed for self-reliance through some form of what was called socialism, but I think we could call it a kind of social welfare state system with the important role of the state in monitoring the economy and actually owning some of what were called the major heights, which indeed it tried to do so and regulate that way the development of the economy. Remains locked into primary commodity production, mainly agriculture, for export as a way to get the necessary imports. Was a country among the poorest in Africa, also very low level of educational development, therefore depended upon an import not only of goods, but of persons in the sense of experts, so that the technological input was important as we needed it. And now is under increasing pressure to promote more export orientation. What this has meant in certain areas is that people will talk about it. We are enslaved to tea. We are enslaved to tobacco. Producers have had to take land away from food and put it into export. Women as well as men. It may be that a combination of forces has made it so that it may be that this is a better payer for labor in certain areas. And the state can't do otherwise in the sense that it is indebted. It requires foreign exchange. The world operates in this way through foreign currencies. And therefore, it has to find a way to get more of that. So that the state, per se, is stuck in a kind of squeeze. It itself is facing a kind of financial intensification. And so I think we should see this new phase of colonial domination today. Guns remain important in Africa as elsewhere, but finance is the name of the game. It's financial manipulations which are subjugating states in Africa to the whims and demands of capital outside and the large powers within. And there's definitely the new agriculture policy, which was more or less established in 1982, tries to promote both. It says it wants to promote both small scale peasant production on the one hand and large scale private and public production on the other. In fact, in a situation of sparse resources, faced with the demands from large-scale agriculture, local and foreign-owned, private and public, which says we have a problem of labor on the one hand, we have a problem of inputs on the other. Where are the sparse tractors and fertilizers going to go? What will be the labor policies involved? So far, the evidence is such that it will be the larger-scale agriculture in favor, and that seems to be related to the mind that Mozambique comes in. The quickest way to resolve the food problem seems to be large-scale agriculture. The quickest way to resolve the problem of getting the producers to produce cotton is to put it in the hands of a large-scale operator who will then force certain wage laborers to produce what is required. Somebody calls this going over the heads of the peasants as a way to resolve the agricultural crisis. And this does seem to be what's been happening in Tanzania. Now, there's a real implication here for women. There has already been an experience in Tanzania recently, as in Zimbabwe and I think other countries in Africa, of rounding up women who were not officially married in the countryside, trying to ship them to the farms, in the cities, and trying to ship them to the countryside, of telling men and women in town they must be economically engaged. But the definition was such that a woman brewing a beer is not economically engaged. A woman who is making a living by selling what are called mandazi buns, or selling other kinds of foodstuffs, which the poor people rely upon as their major source of food, are being told this is not economic engagement. You must prove that you have a farm that you're operating on and go back to the countryside. Now, we can see how the impulse, the reason for the state having to take those kinds of policies. But it does mean a kind of going back to the idea of keeping women on the farm, keeping women in the countryside to resolve labor problems, to reduce the cost the state has incurred of importing food to provide during times of scarcity and that kind of thing. I would argue that it's also, when you jump over the heads of the peasants, it means you no longer worry about economic incentives for the small producers. You no longer worry about raising the purchasing power of the people to create a home market, because you're increasingly thinking about the international market. So there's a logic economically to what's happening. And when people don't have economic incentives to produce more, they don't even have the goods in the shops to buy with whatever little money they get, which has happened in Tanzania, it's almost everywhere now during the 70s crisis. You then are forced to use coercive measures instead. And that will be things like locking people up in the countryside, making it difficult to move around, and that kind of thing. Now, the World Bank says, it's funny because on the one hand they're all for privatization, etc., but they do say, they do show in their studies how adaptable and efficient the small-scale producer is. And what they really mean is, at a time of declining world prices, at a time of declining prices even for nationally marketed goods, somehow if the small family farm can make it, how can they make it on the backs of women? Because the cost of labor, of family labor, is not usually included. Mm-hmm. People have no other choice but to keep working harder. So it means they're forced to expand more land, they're forced to use their labor more intensively to get less returns for their output, for their production overall. So that it's adaptable from one side, but of course women, if they had other options, they look for them. Because of course they don't want to work that much harder to get less for what they are doing. So that I would argue that this city and country kind of thing that was referred to concerning migrant labor system, etc. In South Africa, there's a way in which it's also, it was there in Tanzania and it's developing again in a different form, but very much in response to this being locked into export for a global market, relying upon primary commodity production, increasingly which I would argue is going to come from larger scale enterprises, but also from the peasant producer, where women represent an important source of family labor, but also casual labor in the larger scale enterprises. And I would like to close by saying, this new colonization going on, I think, is related to the creation of a new form of a state. And it's a global state. And I've come across economists who we have thought of as sympathizers to Africa, like Jerry DeLiner, talking about the need for a global manager, that there's a need to discipline the states. And they don't just mean the third world poor states. They also mean states like Sweden and Denmark that have persisted in providing funds to Tanzanian experiment as a quality importation was to the national liberation movements in South Africa. They actually, in the World Bank recent paper on sub-Saharan Africa, talked about the need for countries to put aside their immediate commercial interests for the longer term goals of development. That is said to be directed specifically to the Scandinavian countries.